Well, I want to give just a quick review of the things we looked at yesterday. Our special assignment from God, the day in which we live, is a special moment in history. There aren't very many special moments in history that come along. I think I used the word epic yesterday. If I didn't, I'm going to use the word epic today. It is the appropriate word to describe these amazing times in which we live, which the world has never seen before. I do believe that these are the most interesting days in the last 2,000 years. One of the problems that we have is that seldom do people realize the historic when they're living through it. In other words, people are living through amazing, different, changing days in ways that we've never seen before, and it's only afterwards they look back and they say, wow, those were amazing, epic, unprecedented days. Partly this is true because the math has slipped its leash and was last seen going vertical. The math has just, there's one editorialist that says, I've lost track of the zeros. That's exactly right. We have math today that even the mathematicians do not understand and the economists do not understand. And it's blasting right through past the stratosphere like a rocket. Change also is supersonic, far beyond our ability to really gain our equilibrium. The change is not necessarily wrong. I have changing to do. God has a change agenda for my life, but not all this change is righteous change. And so the math and the change are levels we have never even close to seeing before. And having said that it's the most interesting time in the last 2,000 years, that's just not my opinion. That is a scientific statement. That is a mathematical statement. It is a time chosen by God himself for us. And I'm talking about you. You might be in the 14th row, like the sixth person in. God specifically sat down and thought about you and thought about your life and made a decision as to when you would be born. Again, from Psalm 139, we read yesterday, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. God doesn't do random. God doesn't do coincidences. You're not a cosmic accident. This isn't just sort of a fluke. He chose for you to be alive in an epic era. He has faith in your ability to do the ministry that he's going to put before you. Your job is not to be overwhelmed by clutter and distractions so that you can't see clearly what God has for you to do. This is an amazing time, and I have to say for myself, it clearly has to be regarded as a privilege to be chosen to live today. If I could choose any time across the last 5,000 years, I would choose exactly right now. More is going down on our generational shift than anybody's ever seen. It's a historic day. The entire world is pregnant with something that God himself is giving birth to. And there are battles that are heating up, and it's an amazing time to know him and to be able to rest in his sovereignty. This is the last sign of the times. This is Newsweek. And this is the one I don't want to have happen to you. Now, of course, exhaustion is normal, right? I mean, we all get exhausted. But I don't want you to spend like 8 years chronically exhausted, which is what will happen to you if you just stay on the default cultural treadmill of the more and more of everything faster and faster. That is your destination. But what happens to your joy when you're exhausted? What happens to your interruptibility? What happens to your sense of the priorities that God has given you to accomplish in your life? The great joy that we have for, as an assignment from him to accomplish these particular kinds of ministries. This is Harvard University president. They have a real exhaustion problem there because they have revolving door presidencies. And the guy hit the wall and collapsed. And this is over 10 years old. He hit the wall and collapsed in exhaustion, had to check himself into the hospital for a 3-month sabbatical, emergency. And so Newsweek says, what's up with that? We're not supposed to have exhaustion. We have time-saving technologies. We have labor-saving devices. We have affluence. We have education. We're supposed to be in the post-exhaustion kind of era of living because we have so many things to help us out. And yet everybody that we know talks about how tired they are, how overwhelmed and overloaded and they are. I was in Boston, and a guy came up to me, and I said, I feel like the hamster on the exercise wheel, only the hamster's dead, and the wheel's still going around. Another person said, I feel like a minnow in a flash flood. The interesting thing about this is, they point out in this article, the futurists in the past were not predicting that this would be our destination, that people would feel exhausted. As a matter of fact, the prediction in the 60s is that by now people would feel boredom. The exact opposite of exhaustion. That's what they were all predicting. I was in the 60s, and furthermore, I was paying attention If you know anything about the 60s, that was remarkable in and of itself. But I remember listening to what these people were predicting. They were predicting that technology and computers and automation and progress would feed into productivity. Productivity would go like that. Wages are tied to productivity, so wages would go like that. The prediction was by today, you'd have one wage earner per family working 20 hours a week, and that would be enough. One wage earner per family working 20 hours a week, and that'd be enough. Based on good science, nobody questioned it. The exact opposite happened. And so my question is, has this finished backfiring, or is it going to continue to backfire? Because the problem today is not boredom. The problem today is not too much leisure. The problem is overload, too much stress, too much change, too much complexity. Let me give you some signs and symptoms related to this. 36% of Americans say they're rushed all the time. The average middle manager is interrupted 202 times a day. IBM did a study, and they said the average office worker starts something new every 3 minutes. We spend 8 months of our lives opening junk mail or junk email. The average American gets about 3 hours less sleep per night than in 1850. In 1850, people got 9.5 hours of sleep per night. That was before electricity. What did you do when it got dark? When's the earliest it gets dark here? 4:45 or something? What did you do when it got in 1850? When you lived right here, you know, take the building away. There's a house here, a little hut here. People lived here. It got dark at 4:45. What did you do? You went to bed because you could have candles or you could have oil or you could, you know, you could have a fire. But that stuff was expensive. You didn't have a lot of it. So people slept 9.5 hours per night. By 1910, electricity had been invented, started coming into the night. So it was from 9.5 hours down to 9 hours. By 1950, it was down to 8 hours. By 1990, it was down to 7 hours. And now we're about 6.5 hours of sleep per night. So we have some like 30 to 80 million Americans have sleep disorder problems. This is not a figment of our imagination. Something is happening. 56% of Americans are more exhausted after a vacation than before the vacation started. How about prayer? There's a guy who did a prayer research, and he says 85% of Christians say that they do all their praying or most of their praying on the run. Jennifer Glass, University of Iowa, she has a PhD degree on how people use their time. She says it takes 20 to 30 phone calls in the average church to get the same number of volunteers it used to take 2 to 3 phone calls to get. Did you know that two-thirds of people feel that 89% of people feel that texting while driving is dangerous, and two-thirds of them do it anyway. 63% of us who have mobile devices check our email in our pajamas on our bed. So at any rate, there's signs and symptoms that there is a new epidemic, and it's new. It is new, and it was not expected, and it might be after us, and it might be after the church. A pastor's wife once told me all the evil one has to do to neutralize the church is keep us stressed out and running all the time. Very effective strategy. There are three eras of progress, three eras in the last 5,000 years of recorded history that I want to touch on very quickly. The first one is 3100 BC to about 1750, about 5,000 years. There wasn't any progress. Occasionally, there were little bits of progress, but mostly life was slow, it was destitute, it was tragic, it was very difficult, and the world you died out of was the same as the world you're born into. You know what life expectancy was at the time of Jesus? 21 years. Doesn't mean everybody died at age 21, but that was the average life expectancy at the time of Jesus. Shakespeare was born in the early 1500s. The world he died out of was the same as the world he was born into. In 1750, things started to change. The Industrial Revolution, Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, economics. We started with health care, a little bit with Enlightenment. I don't particularly like the Enlightenment because they're so against religion, but they did have democracy and universal education, those kinds of things. So all of a sudden, we saw progress just taking off, and it was going like that. We had a flat line for like 5,000 years, and then it started taking off and going like that. And then we hit about 2000, about 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago. We don't have the story of progress anymore. We have the story of profusion. We have the story of more. Because progress used to exist to make our lives better. That's the definition of progress. Now progress exists to give us more. We don't need more anymore. We are already overloaded, but progress is going to continue to give us more. So this is the new story. We are in the third era. The conditions today are radically different than the other two eras. But this is axiomatically, automatically what progress will give us at exponential rates now that can't stop because our economy is dependent on progress doing this. If progress stopped giving us more, if progress stopped differentiating, proliferating, the economy would absolutely go into depression and we would all have horrible lives in certain senses. And so it has to continue to do. We're on a track that cannot be reversed in a certain sense without everything falling apart globally. What's God's opinion of this? Does God want to give us more microwaves? Only one thing is needed. You know, you think about the Bible, and it's big, right? You've got the Old Testament, New Testament, all these books, all these chapters, all these verses. The Bible focuses in. Remember this passage at the end of Luke 10. There's the Jesus and the disciples, and they're going into Bethany, and they sit down at the house of Mary and Martha. And Martha, God bless her. I'm sure that Jesus absolutely loved Martha, and many of you know this story. And she's in the kitchen, and she's had this unexpected company, and now all of a sudden she has to cook for these people and take care of these people. Hospitality was a big deal. And there's Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus, out in the living room, just soaking up every word he's saying. And all of a sudden, Martha had enough, and she opens the door, and she goes in there, and she says, Jesus, tell Mary to get in here and help me. I'm in here doing all this work, and I'm doing it all by myself, and she's sitting out there, and you should tell her to get in here and help me because I'm doing it all by myself. And Jesus looked at her. Now, here's the question. What was the countenance that Jesus had when he looked at Martha? I think he had a twinkle in his eye. I don't think he was scornful of her. I think he really loved Martha. That's my own personal opinion of it. And he looked to Martha and he says, Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things. Only one thing is needful. Mary has chosen the better portion. It will not be taken away from her. So remember the more we were talking about? Jesus says, one thing is needed. How about this one here? Seek first the kingdom of God. This isn't seek like 180 things today. Seek first the kingdom of God. Matthew 6:33, Sermon on the Mount. How about this one here? Matthew 22, the greatest commandment. So here, the teacher of the law comes and they're having this session with Jesus. What's the greatest commandment? There's like 630 commandments. I mean, somewhere in that vicinity. Yeah, some people say 613, whatever. There's a lot of commandments in the Old Testament. And they say, what's the greatest commandment? The whole universe holds its breath while we hear what Jesus has to say about it. This is important stuff. There's all these commandments, and you have to do all these commandments. But what sits at the mountaintop? What is on the pinnacle? What is above everything else that you have to put your eye on and never deviate your attention and your focus from the greatest commandment? And the story comes from Deuteronomy 6. First, the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God, heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second is like unto the first. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And so you see that the scriptures are very focusing for us and our priorities. Wonderful solution and prescription for the profusion and the more that and the clutter that in many ways the evil one is throwing in our direction. Well, progress automatically leads to stress, change, complexity, speed, and overload. Now, these are not necessarily bad. We looked at stress yesterday. Is stress bad? No, it isn't. God himself created the stress mechanism, the ability for us to adapt to any change in our life. You are very, very adaptable. And the most rigorous definition of stress is that, your ability to adapt. Good change, bad change, you can adapt to it. Where if you have no stress, you have no productivity, and you die. If you have zero stress, if you never trigger the adaptability mechanism in your life, you will die. If you have small amounts of stress, you'll be bored. So you don't want hypostress, or you don't want no stress, but you don't want hyperstress either. Up here, we're talking about exhaust, this part right here, and fatigue and burnout. So many people in America live here. Now, you can visit here and be fine. You can be here for 2 weeks and be fine. I mean, doctors have flu season in this town. That's a really busy time. Clergy have holy season, holy time, where where you got Advent or you got the Christmas or you got Easter. Those are very busy times. If you're an accountant, you have tax time. You can do that. You have finals and you have big papers or something that you have to do. So you can live over here, but if you live there for like 8 years, reliably, dysfunction will come into your life of many different forms. And so many people today live here. And it can be hard on ministry because you're going through the motions. You don't care about these people anymore. You act like you do because Jesus is telling you to do that, but there's no confirming passion left. You put your ladle down into the well and you pull your ladle in, there's nothing in the ladle. So stress is good, but too much stress is not good. Change also is good. God has a change agenda for my life, but the kind of change we're seeing today is dysfunctional. Complexity. I mentioned how the average American has to learn how to operate 20,000 different pieces of technology. And even though I have a physics degree, I don't know how to set the clock on my car radio. Linda went into a university library. There was a sign on the copy machine that says, use at your own risk. Linda gave me permission to say this. She has she graduated at the top of her college class, but some time back she spent 5 minutes trying to rewind a DVD. In San Francisco a couple years back, they had primary elections. The primary elections, they had absentee ballots. The absentee ballots had 147 pages in them. Complexity. Progress leads to complexity, but the gospel message is outrageously simple. The gospel message is God saying to you, to the world, I love you. I do not hold your sins against you. Won't you let me rescue you? Jesus said, if I'll be lifted up, I'll draw everybody unto myself. You know, if you're not helping with the drawing, then get out of his way. It's very simple. Kids across the globe with no education whatsoever have access to the simplicity of the gospel message. A.W. Tozer says, very seldom today in our churches do we see the simplicity of the gospel message. How about speed? Progress leads to speed. Every year, the world's spinning faster. The treadmill's spinning faster. And I don't have a problem with fast. Here's park, and here's slow, and here's fast, and here's faster, and here's too fast. Oh, I have a problem with too fast. Faster is okay. Fast is okay. Slow and park, those are good gears too. Too fast is not good. There's a line right here. And when you go too fast, again, things are going to start backfiring in your life. I heard about a guy, he says, I got myself a microwave fireplace. That way I can sit in front of the fire all evening in just 8 minutes. James Thurber says, man is flying too fast for a world that is round. Soon he will catch up with himself in a great rear-end collision. What about Jesus in hurry? Jesus didn't do it. Jesus didn't jog. He was never in a hurry. He was never in a speed race. If Jesus was in a speed race, he would have won it. He wasn't in a speed race. He was in a love race. He won that. You say, oh, it's the cultural context. I mean, you know, toga, sandals, it's hard to jog when you're dressed like that. Has nothing to do with the cultural context. You bring Jesus today, put him in Nikes, he's not in a hurry. Jesus invented the clock. He invented time. He's going to now, time is going to bully him. What was ministry for Jesus? The person standing in front of him at the time. Jesus didn't travel many places. He didn't teach everybody. He did not cure every case of leprosy in Israel. I'll say that again. Jesus did not cure every case of leprosy in Israel. Even though he could have gone like this, let's get all the lepers in this room and I could just, okay, in an hour, could have cured you all. Could have held clinic 23 hours a day. He didn't do it. His ministry was the person standing in front of him. He was, for that person, exactly what that person needed. And he was not in a hurry. When I first realized that, I said, the person in front of me is an obstacle. I'm trying to get over, under, around. You're a patient of mine. I'm busy. I'm an hour behind. Yes, I mean, I care for you, sort of, maybe, but, you know, I'm late. So there's my hand on the door. And I realized that the way Jesus did ministry and the way I was doing life and ministry were exact opposites. And I said, something has to change. And I changed my life. Radically changed my life based on that. Let's hurry a little fast out of the gas station. I was in Canada, and the lady came up to me, and she says, yeah, I did that, but they don't have this detachment thing at the holes at the pump, and so I actually pulled the pump down the road twice. She said, I did it twice. So progress will lead to increasing speed, and so maybe you're going fast now, and then you're going faster, but later on, you will be going too fast. I taught the young doctors for 15 years with the University of Wisconsin. I said, you need to have multiple gears. You need to have a fast gear, but you need to have a park gear, too. Park gear is biblical. We've lost track of where we left our park gear, but to be still and wait patiently for him. These are biblical notions. Okay, the last one is overload. Progress will lead to overload. What does that look like? I got a couple pictures of overload. £3,000 over his back axle, 800 pounds of concrete in his back seat. Only in America. And it lasted about 6 feet backing up there. That's his wife. He's in a coma. She's in a coma, and the guy was last seen jogging down the street. That's actually remarkable in many ways, isn't it? That's what an amazing thing. Now, this is... it's either overload or it's really cute, and maybe it's both. Whoops. I think that's concrete. If you can see the way the truck... Do you have a theology of human limits? You see, this is getting back into exactly what we're talking about here. Progress is assaulting human limits. Do we have them? Do you have a science or a psychology or a theology of human limits? Well, yeah, I think I do. I have 24 hours a day. You might be the most pious person in this entire school. God's not going to give you an extra 5 seconds. He's not going to give you a half of 1 second extra just because you're pious. He doesn't do that. You are stuck with 24 hours a day. I mean, a couple times in the Bible it was violated, right? But not recently. Time limits. We have financial limits. We have a certain amount of money in our wallet. We have physical limits. We have to sleep, for example. You can't walk from here to San Francisco in 3 minutes. We have emotional limits. We have intellectual limits. The brain is capable of 10,000 trillion computations per second. 10,000 trillion computations per second. But you can't find your keys. You know, can't remember where you put your car. We can't multitask very well. The brain is more amazing than the fastest supercomputer on the face of the earth. And yet we have intellectual limits. If I, for example, were to read two healthcare-related articles, if I were to read two articles per day about medicine and healthcare, next year at this time, I would be 1,000 years behind in my reading because all of the articles that are out there. We are created finite. It was one of God's best ideas to make us finite and to give us limits because he says, you know what? It's not about you. It's about me. He says, when you are limited, when you are weak, when you are empty, when you are broken, I love it because then you will look to me and you will depend upon me and I can flow my resources, I can flow my power and my wisdom into you. The fact that I have limits in no way means that God has limits. God does not have limits. He's the one without limits. I'm the one that's with limits. He's the infinite one. I'm the finite one. He's the creator. I'm the creature. And it's good for us to remember that. God once spoke and the universe showed up. You remember that one? 10 to the 50th tons, which is one with 50 zeros. That's more than a trillion, 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 trillion tons. And that's not 4 trillion. It's a trillion, 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 trillion tons. He did that. How much have I created in my life? Zero. You cannot create mass or energy and you cannot destroy them. It's precluded by the laws of physics. All of humanity has not created 1 ounce of anything ever. So you see, I'm limited, but God isn't. And it's only when you connect with God's power and God's wisdom in your life that you will see the awesome things that he has planned for you and in store for you. But as long as we depend on the arm of flesh and our human wisdom. Remember Paul, he got disgusted with the thorn of flesh, and he appealed to God 3 times. He said, would you deliver me from this? And God says, no, I'm not going to do that. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Now, Paul was type AAA driven workaholic, in case you wondered. I mean, he was a driven human being, and I thought he'd have a temper tantrum. He didn't. This is what Paul said. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, for when I am weak, then I am strong. You see, the church has an answer for the more and more of everything, faster and faster progress. It is Jesus himself. We simplify our lives in the direction of Christ, and he gives us what we need. These are symptoms of overload. Okay, there's a lot of different symptoms there. Maybe additional ones should be on there. But you will probably find one or two or three or four symptoms that recur each time when you get really too stressed out and too overloaded. That's called your symptom complex. Yours is different than mine, is different than somebody over here. The top line, apathy, withdrawal, depression, work dread. Depression is increasing in all Western countries at younger and younger ages. Isn't that interesting indictment of progress? Why is the good life only endurable under sedation? It's a strange thing to think about. Irritability, anger, hostility. Very common, these things. Irritability is one of my... I have two symptoms here. Irritability is one of my hallmark symptoms. I'm not an irritable person. Sometimes I am. When I become irritable, is I'm too stressed out, I'm too overloaded. It's a nice symptom for me to realize I have to throttle down, I have to slow down a little bit. Frustration, disorganization, mistakes. A CPA, an accountant, came to me at an accountant conference I was speaking. He says, I know I get overloaded, I start making mistakes. Poor judgment, fatigue, burnout, moral failure, relational problems, risk-taking, excessive self-medication, trouble sleeping, sleeping too little, sleeping too much, trouble with eating patterns, GI, that's a gastrointestinal or cardiovascular symptoms or headaches. Headaches, that's my second one. My mother got migraines, my grandfather got migraines, so I'm the one who inherited that. So irritability and migraines, I don't like either one of those. Why would I want to live there? It's my body speaking to me and saying what you need to do is to slow down a little bit. When overload hits faith, we're too busy to pray. This is in your future unless you guard against it. Too busy to pray, too busy to serve, too exhausted for relationships. Irritability poisons our attitude and our joy. God gets the busy signal. And this is new. This particular kind of pathology is new. Let me give you a scenario here. I'll role play for you. I won't make you do that for me. This is 80%, and that's 100%, that's 120%. So you're over here, and say you're a physician, and your colleague comes to you, and your colleague says, I have a family crisis. My sister's having cancer surgery down in Chicago, and I'm supposed to be on call this weekend. I need somebody to take my call. And I thought of you. Would you possibly do that? Could you do that for me? And you say, sure. Yeah, I'll do that. I had some space in my life. I got a little margin going here, and I like my work. I like you. I like my patients. I hope your sister's okay. You'll help me out sometime? Sure, not a problem at all. They call from the soccer league, and they say the soccer coach for the fourth grade kids, she broke her leg. And she's out for 2 months, and we need a replacement, and we just thought maybe you might be interested in doing that. And you say, soccer, that's outside, isn't it? Yeah, and those kids laugh, I think. I need laughter and outside. I'll do that. That'd be thanks a lot for asking me. You go home and say if you're married, and your spouse says, let's take the neighbors out to dinner on Friday night. They've lived there, I think, 4 or 5 years. I don't even know what they look like. And you say, well, let's call them up. I mean, let's call them up right now. What have we been doing? We should call them up. Go to take them out to dinner. You get to 100%, and your colleague comes to you and says, would you take my call this weekend? And you say, well, I mean, I'd love to, but I don't know if I can, really. My life is really maxed out. Our plate is really full. I'll have to go home, check my calendar, because it's just, my family would annihilate me if I did something like that. And oh, I hope your sister's okay. I'll let you know in the morning. Okay, I'll do it. I don't know how I'll do it, but I'll do it. But just this once. It's not precedent setting, okay? And you walk away from there and you say, what's happening to me? I always wanted to help people out. I don't even care about this guy anymore. I think I'm getting selfish. They call from the soccer league and they say, could you coach the fourth grade kids? And you say, you know, I would love to do that and I appreciate your calling me, but call me down the road when life gets better. You know, then I will do it because right now I just can't fit it in. And you go home, and spouse says, how about taking the neighbors out to dinner on Friday night? And you say, let's do that. We really should do that. Maybe September of next year. I think we could put that on our calendar for September next year. You get to 120%, and your colleague comes up to you and says, would you take my call this weekend? And you say, stop right there. I quit. I'm sick and tired. Everybody dumping their problems on my desk, expecting me to bail them out at the last minute. Happens every day, every week. As long as I've been here, I've had it up to here. Where's the door? I'm out of here. They call from the soccer league, and they say, could you coach the fourth grade kids? And you say, I hate kids. And you're an idiot. Who gave you my phone number? Don't you ever call me again. And you go home and your spouse says, how about taking the neighbors out to dinner on Friday night? And you say, you can do that if you want. I'm coming home at 5:30. I'm closing the door. I'm locking the door. I'm deadbolting the door. I'm closing the curtains. I'm turning off the lights. I'm pushing the television refrigerator next to the bed. I'm going to bed. I'm not getting up till Monday at 8:30 in the morning, but you can do anything you want. Now, let me ask you a question or two about this. What changed in these three scenarios? Was it the thing asked of you? No. The thing asked of you was exactly the same in all three situations. Now, a follow-up question. In which of these three scenarios were you a better advertisement for the kingdom of God? In which of these scenarios did you stand in better as a representative of Jesus Christ himself to the person in front of you at the time? If you have no margins, so many things that the Scripture is asking us to do will be held hostage. I know doctors who are over here at 132%, and they went to medical school to help people with their problems, with their illnesses, and now they spend their professional career resenting people for needing their help because their illnesses represent a threat to my vitality. They say, I don't care if your ulcer's bleeding, deal with it. So margin. This is the space between our life, between our load and our limits. It has to do with our reserves. If you're at 90% or 80%, you have some margin there. If you're at 128% all your life, you have no margin. You're overloaded. You're marginless. We already talked about ministry for Jesus being the person in front of him at the time. Margin is not a word that you'll find in the Bible, but everything the Bible asks us to do implies that we have some margin and we make it available for the purposes of God. When Scripture says, carry one another's burdens, if you are 128%, you will not fulfill the law of Christ. You won't do this. I can prove this sociologically, scientifically, research. I can prove that you will not be interested in your neighbor's burdens. Walk the second mile, the Sermon on the Mount. Somebody said the second mile is never crowded. Margin is assumed when God asks us to help the wounded person in the middle of the road, that person right there. That's a part of the greatest commandment. We need to remember that. That is the illustration. Love your neighbor as yourself. Who's my neighbor? There he is. From Jerusalem down to Jericho, beaten up by thieves. The priest and the Levite ran by on the other side. Dr. Swenson, man, I just flew by at 80 miles an hour because I'm late for that meeting in Jericho. It was the Samaritan, the despicable person who interrupted the schedule, bound up the wounds, paid the bill, brought him to the inn. And Jesus says, well, who's the neighbor? It's the one who loved, who interrupted the schedule. And yet, if you don't have space in your life, you won't do it. Margin is assumed when God asks us to witness to the hope that we have within us about the truth that God has given us at any opportunity. When we teach our children, we sit, walk, lie, and stand, Deuteronomy 6. We be still and wait patiently for him. Let me give you a little story from Princeton University. Where's Dr. Wood? Is he still, is he around? You didn't give this story to him, did you? Did you give this story to him? Great, okay. Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, he talks about this study that was done at Princeton Seminary, as a matter of fact. And the seminarians, when they came into, they made the seminarians, say it's a group like you, and they made you into guinea pigs for this little research project. One of the things that they asked is, why did you come to seminary? They said, was it to be a practical help to people on a daily basis, or was it the deep theological and philosophical discussions about life? Those are not mutually exclusive. I mean, you could do both of those, but it defines a spectrum. I mean, here's the people who want to be practical help, and over here is all the, you know, just the deep philosophy. The second variable here is they assigned them one of six talks. And so they say, okay, this group right here, your job is to give a quick little extemporaneous talk about the parable of the Good Samaritan. That's your job over here. Your job is to talk about this. Your job is to talk about this. And so they split them up in that way. And then the third variable, and the students didn't know that, is they came in one at a time. And come on up here, John. Okay, well, it's time to give your talk. It's over there at the library. And whoa, you're late. You better get over there right away because they've been sitting waiting for you for like 5 minutes. Half of the students got that. The other half of the students, they came in and they said, okay, go over there and give your talk. And you're running pretty early now, but go over there now anyway. And you can hang up your coat, get a drink of water, think about things a little bit. And then they'll tell you when it's time to come in. They wanted to see what would happen to these students because between here and where they had to give the talk, there was a plant. There was a man on his hands and knees with his head sticking in an alley, coughing, sputtering, gagging, acting like he was going to die any second. And they wanted to see the reaction of these seminarians as they passed directly in front of that man or over that man or behind that man. Do you think those who went to seminary to be a practical help to people on a daily basis, do you think that they stopped more than those who were there for the deep theological stuff? No, it was the same. It was the exact same percentage of people that stopped. So that didn't make any difference. How about those that had just prepared a talk on the parable of the Good Samaritan? Do you think they stopped? No. It did not increase their chance of stopping at all. Two of the guys stepped over the body to go give their talk on the parable of the Good Samaritan. How about those that had a little extra time? Yeah, 63% of them stopped. 10% who had no time stopped. What I'm discussing here is not pop psychology. This is doing the will of the Father, the practical level. Day by day. Emotional and margin emotional energy. Let me just cover this because we already covered half of that yesterday, and then we'll take a break, and we'll come back for the second part. All therapeutics here. The things you can do, and I've written over 600 prescriptions, practical ideas of things you can do, and we'll go through probably 20 of them here. We already looked about relationships. You see, what do I mean, margin and emotional energy? When you start the day, you have a certain bank account of emotional energy inside of you. You know, it's like a gas tank or something. I can't tell you how much that is. I wish I could put a number to that, but I can't. All I know, it's not infinite. And as you're going throughout the day, you're discharging that emotional energy out, and you're also receiving back. Your first major discharge is when you look in a mirror. I mean, that's a major four-alarm bummer. And then you get to work, and you have tons of work that you have to do, and somebody calls, and they're really annoying, and so you're draining out, but you turn on the radio and there's a song that comes on and you hadn't heard this one in a while and it's just so great. And then somebody tells a joke and you laugh and you laugh and you're making a fool of yourself and your nose is dripping and you're rolling on the floor and you feel euphoric. And then somebody else comes up to you, the next class you go to, and a person comes in and says, you know, you are just such an awesome person. Yeah, it's just such a pleasure having a class with somebody like you, the caliber and the character of you. You just always inspire me. So this person is just building you up. So we're draining out and we're receiving back. We honestly thought in America that progress would fill people up and we wouldn't need counselors anymore. That isn't happening. Progress allows us to be better off, but people are not any happier. The countries that have the most progress are not any happier than the countries that don't. So one of the things that we need for this is where the gospel comes in, is relationships. And relationships are being harmed under the tutelage of progress. This more and more of everything faster and faster is shredding the social fabric of our country, even in the church. And so invest yourself in some people. And we looked at that yesterday from Ecclesiastes 4. Reconciliation, we talked about that. Why carry 50 pounds of rocks on your back when you don't have to do it? It's an enormous drain on our emotional vitality. And God has given, you say, what am I supposed to do? I mean, that person is just such a jerk, and you can't believe what they did to me, and I would be willing to get together, but they're not. I'm just saying, I don't know about the theology. I'll just be your doctor for a while. I'll just say, declare unilateral peace. Don't give that person, because they are being difficult, as they always are, don't give that person that kind of power over the rest of your life, because they refuse to take the rocks off and set them down. Let them carry their rocks if they want to. Now, about the theology of this, you'll have to go talk to the theologians in terms of about, I'm just saying, declare unilateral peace. Service. We know that service works. We've done studies on people. If there's a fire Lord forbid, 30 miles from here, and there's five houses that burned down. If you put a rake and a shovel in your car and go and help those families for one day, I can guarantee you something positive will happen to your physiology. Something positive will happen to your emotional well-being. It's a powerful factor. But when you're too overloaded, nobody has time to serve. Linda serves people all the time. Before she's getting out of bed, she's thinking about people that she's going to serve. And that's why I said there'll be 10,000 people at her funeral. One of the stories I have in the book is she was down at the convenience store, and she was she's making some cherry pie at home, and she was just getting some ice cream. And she talks to people. I mean, there's one college kid like you that was clerking there, the only other person in the store, and Linda actually talked. I would have just paid the money and walked out, you know, but Linda talks to people. She said, oh, I'm making cherry pie, and we're going to have cherry pie a la mode. And kid says, boy, that sounds good. 10 minutes later, Linda comes in the store with a slice of cherry pie, scoop of ice cream, hands it to the kid. Simple, isn't it? And yet, that's the kingdom. That's the way the kingdom is supposed to look. We had a straight line windstorm come in our town in 1980. Broke the wind meters 117 miles per hour. You couldn't drive down a single block in Menominee. Trees were down everywhere. Our clinic was closed for 48 hours. My nurse downtown, she didn't have electricity for 9 days. And after everybody figured out that everybody's okay, it was kind of like a spirit of holiday in our town because everybody went and helped everybody else. It was an amazing, amazing thing. We grabbed our chainsaws and we just sort of started going around town and just helping one another. And within a few days, there were people that were coming into a town and would say, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Pennsylvania. How about you? Ohio? How about you, Michigan? And then we asked them, well, what are you doing here? This is late summer. And they said, well, we're Mennonites, and what we do is we work real hard and we put money aside for, you know, like 6 months. And then we just kind of come to a place like this and see what we can do to help. And so they would go out to a farmer, and the farmer's barn is blown down, and they knock on the door. And the farmer opens the door and they said, we're here to help you rebuild your barn. And the farmer says, oh, I didn't call anybody. I mean, I don't... Maybe it's the guy down the street. I'll give him a call and see if he's expecting you. And they said, no, you don't understand. We're here to help you rebuild your barn. And they did. And now the farmer gets up in the morning, 20 years later, 30 years later, and he gets dressed, and he goes into the barn. But it's more than a barn. I mean, it's a gift now. And that's the way you make the world a better place. But who has time to serve? Literally. Rest, we talk about rest, that God is a pro-rest God. We talked about the free three, laughter, music, and nature, all around the world. Do you understand already from the hand of God, we have all this help? You see, what you don't need another piece of technology. You don't need another sofa. What you need is a person to love and to serve and to, you know, you need a group of, we need community. We need laughter and music and nature because imagine Jesus with those kids. I can understand that life was stressful for him, and he couldn't wait to get around the four-year-old kids. What about vision? There has been a collapse of vision in American society. There was a survey among men in college. 25% of them said yes to the question, is life a meaningless existential hell? 25% said yes. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, says, humankind is a bubble of consciousness floating on an ocean of nothingness until the bubble pops. Do you have a vision of the meaning of life? Do you understand why you're doing the things you're doing? You know, we know the Word. We know God. God has come and walked among us. We look God in the face. We know about the cross. We know about the tomb. We know that our sins are forgiven. We know that we're grafted in. We know that we have an inheritance that's incorruptible. We stand on a foundation that's unmovable and unshakable. We have the mind of God. We have the community of believers. This is something to sell. The world is looking for a vision like this, a vision that's bigger than ourselves, that includes the common good, that is possible and positive. Gratitude. If I handed you a 3x5 card, all of these things are building up our emotional energy margin. If you have to minister to the needs of broken people, you will be drained. You will need to find ways to build that back up. Gratitude. I hand you a 3x5 card, and you write on there one thing you're grateful for. And after you do that, I hand you another one, and then another one. How many cards would I have to give you before you ran out of things to be grateful for? I hope 10,000. I'm grateful for four-year-old kids. I'm grateful for laughter. I'm grateful for music. I'm grateful that clouds are white. I mean, there are other colors too, but I love those billowy clouds and the sky is blue. I'm so grateful for sunsets. I'm grateful for lakes, and I'm grateful for fish. I'm grateful for muskies, and for walleyes, and for pike, and largemouth bass. And small. I'm even grateful for rock bass. I'm grateful for... I could go on and on. If you exercise your gratitude, you will find that your bank of emotional vitality is larger at the end of that. Grace and goodwill. Grace is treating people better than they deserve. Grace is people treating people better than they deserve. Judgment is treating people as they deserve. Well, we want grace in our lives because if people treated me as I deserve, we'd be at each other's throats. I want to read you a little story about Grandpa. Grandfather was in the backyard. It was mid-morning. His small grandson kept begging him, "Gramps, can I fix you a hamburger?" "No, honey, Gramps is full. Just had breakfast." "Can I fix you a hot dog?" "I don't think a hot dog would mix well with the eggs inside," Gramps said. The child tugged on his grandfather's arms. He burst in an enormous smile. "I know, Gramps, a glass of water?" Grandfather looked into the dirt-smeared face. He wasn't thirsty, but he could see the boy's desire to do something special for the man he most admired. "Yep, I think Gramps could use a drink." The child ran into the kitchen. He happened to pick up a dirty glass from the sink instead of a clean one. He turned on the hot water tap instead of the cold. As he ran out the door with the water, the mud from his hands smeared over the outside of the glass, dribbling inside, clouded the hot water. "Here you are, Gramps." Gramps looked at the awful glass of water and caught the sparkle in the small face. He drank it all and wrapped his arms around the lad. "You know, that was the best glass of water Gramps has ever had." This is a healthy man. I want to find out his address so I can move in next door. If we had these people in the front rows of every church, we wouldn't be able to build churches fast enough. This is a practical illustration of what grace might look like. Goodwill. The father of stress research, Hans Selye, said the greatest thing you can do to insulate your life against the ravages of stress in the future is to spread around goodwill in the lives of other people. You spread around goodwill in the lives of other people, and when hard times comes to you, they will remember, and they will come back and help you and lift you up. And, of course, faith and love. Faith, there are over 2,000 articles and studies on the link between faith and health, almost all of which show a positive association. And I can't even begin to describe adequately about love. Love always wins, even when it's killed. Love always wins. So evil comes in, and love comes in, and evil turns on and it kills it, and love is down there dead. And you say, "What about that?" And I said, God is the judge. And as long as God adjudicates, God points down to love and says, "You win." There's nothing as powerful as love. Well, this is the margin of emotional energy is the first area, and the second area is margin of time. And most people in America think this is the one I want to hear about. I personally think emotional energy is the most important. I mean, you can have $58 billion in the bank. If you're defeated emotionally, it won't mean a thing to you. So emotional energy is God's plan for us is joy and peace and contentment. But margin in time, in a practical sense, is what most people across the United States today want to hear me talk about. I want to start with this quote by Robert Banks. He's an Australian. I think he lives in the States now, and he's kind of a time management sort of guy. And he said, Christian, he says, we can be quite sure that whatever God wishes us to devote ourselves to, he will grant us time enough in which to do it. Our responsibility is to find out exactly what he wants and to hold resolutely to that. One of our greatest problems is that we misunderstand what God asks of us, either by adding all kinds of extra responsibilities or by possessing only a hazy idea of what he wishes. We will gain more time by properly understanding his will for us than by all the time-saving suggestions put together. We need to transition from blaming God for our crazy, business, stressed-out, overloaded lives and understand that the agenda is for me to figure out what God's will for my life is on a practical level on a daily basis, because his will for me is peace and order and rest and contentment in him. Of course there's activity and there's commitment and there's even suffering, and I endorse those things, but God is a God of joy and worship and depth and rest. Margin of time. First thing about this one is to be intentional. If you stay on the default cultural treadmill, more and more of everything faster and faster, next year at this time, you're going to be busier with more stress, more complexity, more overload than you are right now. That's axiomatically, automatically, 100% the direction the treadmill is going. So we have to be intentional about that. And Scripture always treats us as intentional moral agents. You read the Bible and you do what it says. That's what it says in James. Don't just read the Bible and walk away and forget what it says. You read the Bible and do what it says. For example, it says in Philippians 4, let your gentleness be evident to all. Now, is that hard to figure out? You don't have to send the philosophers out to dig that one up, or you don't have to consult. Let your gentleness be evident to all. Okay, we have to be intentional about let my gentleness be evident to all. What about these other issues here that I'm talking about? We have to confront them intentionally. Mary Pfeiffer, she's a best-selling author, not from the Christian genre, but she's produced some exceptional work, and she said if we let culture just happen to us, we'll end up exhausted, addicted, broke, with a house full of junk, and no time. There's a French anthropologist that says history is what happens to people, and what happens to people is always different from what people would rather have done. When I first read that, I said, that is true, that is tragic, it is not going to happen to me. Have you ever heard of Laszlo's Scandinavian Relativity Axiom? Laszlo's Scandinavian Relativity Axiom. I learned this one from the Pentagon. It goes this way: no matter how great your triumphs or how tragic your defeats, there's approximately 20 million Scandinavians who couldn't care less. They're not going to stop their world over there and dedicate their entire national existence to helping you solve your day-to-day problems. They're not ill-intentioned toward you, and neither is your neighbor. But your neighbor isn't going to sort of dedicate their life in order to, you know, do this for us. So we have to be intentional. Learn to say no. I said I have over 600 prescriptions. This is in the top five. It's a hard word, isn't it? One person says no is a complete sentence. No is a hard word to use, and it's difficult because, you know, there's lots of counter incentives to saying no. You don't want to disappoint people. You don't want to disappoint God. The other person helped you out. I mean, you don't want to miss out on opportunities, and so you say yes. But right now, it is just a mathematical necessity. There's one church that says, we teach our people no is a holy word. You're going to have to say no to a lot of non-priorities and lesser priorities in order for you to say yes to the real priorities that God has for you. But look at the mathematics. Say like 20 years ago, you had maybe, well, I shouldn't say 20 years ago. Like, well, anyway, 20 years ago, I had like 25 things to choose from to do today. Now I have 58 things to choose from to do today. If I wait another 15, 20 years, I'll have 104 things to choose from. That's the way it's going. That's the advantage of mathematics. You can project that ahead and see where it's going. And most of these are fun, enjoyable things that you always wanted to do. It's easy to say no to bad things, you know, like a flexible sigmoidoscopy or something, or a root canal, or an IRS audit. I mean, that's not hard. But I'm talking about saying no to enjoyable things, to fishing. I like fishing. I like watching the Cubs. I can start there. There is a theologian, Dr. J. Grant Howard, who says some people can't say no. They enroll in too many courses, hold down too many jobs, volunteer for too many tasks, make too many appointments, serve on too many committees, have too many friends. They're trying to be all things to all people all the time, all by themselves. Not only do we need to say no to these non-priorities, but also to discretionary burdens. Discretionary burdens are the notion that there are some things that we feel that we have to do that you don't actually have to do at all. There was a lady, she was calling her daughter. Her daughter's in college, and the lady said, I have to, you know, I had such a busy day, I had to do this, 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 and now I have to carve the pumpkin tonight. And the daughter says, oh, you have to carve the pumpkin tonight. And the lady thought, I don't, do I? That's a discretionary burden. You don't have to manicure the yard with a toothbrush. You don't have to cut the bushes. You don't have to polish your shoes. You don't have to vacuum the car. You see, if you went Our son and his wife are in Liberia right now. If you went and packed up tomorrow to go to Liberia, when you got there, all the things that you thought you had to do on a daily basis here, you wouldn't even think of there. You absolutely wouldn't. It's not possible to do there. You would leave them on this side of the ocean because it's just impossible to do like anything. I mean, things are very much different. What about Titus 2? This is in the NIV, for the grace of God that teaches us to say no to ungodliness, to worldly passions, to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age, while we wait for the blessed hope, the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. Next, turn off television set. About 1 out of 100 in America don't have a television set. Now, I have a television set. I watch news because my job is to sort of figure out what's going on in the world. But I do have the sneaky suspicion that the wisest people in America are people who don't have televisions. The average now watching television is 5 hours a day. In the average home, it's on like 8.5 hours per day. So people are watching 30 hours of television per week, and they come up to me and they said, well, you know, I've tried this margin. I've tried to simplify. I've tried to cut back on things and my commitments, and I'm still overwhelmed, and I have no time. They're like watching 30 hours of television. One person says, late-night television is very educational. It teaches you should have gone to bed earlier. There are more televisions in America now than there are people. There are more televisions in the average home than there are people in the average home. Anyway, probably 100 billion hours a day. But what did we do, say, in the average person, 30 hours of television per week? What did we do with those 30 hours before the television invented? Let's back it up to like 1928. Is it possible we lingered at the dinner table? Helped the kids with homework, visited with the neighbors, dug in the gardens, read great books, took long walks, slept full nights. I'm trying not to romanticize the past, but you had to find a use for 30 hours. I mean, maybe it was that in the days before television, but practice simplicity and contentment. I'm going to talk about that. I don't know how people are going to get margin if they don't value these two things, which are theological gifts in many ways to us. But why would I have it under time? So we're going to talk about it under finances. Why would I have it under time? Because everything you owns you, and everything that you own takes your time. You have to spend time with it. You have to dust it, maintain it. You have to organize it. You have to work to pay it off. You have to paint it. Einstein had a whole bunch of suits, but they were all the same suit. He didn't want to think about suits. He changed his clothes, but I mean, he wanted to think about relativity. He didn't want to think about clothes. This is what I have. I don't have anything besides this. And this is what I've been wearing basically for the last 20 years that I've been speaking. I mean, you know, I changed it when the time comes to change it, but I can get dressed in the dark. I know what I'm going to take on the road. And some places I'm overdressed and some places I'm underdressed. Fine, don't invite me back. This is it. Jesus would be very similar to that. And sometimes if we can simplify our lives and simplify, deliberately limit the options and choices in our life, we find out that we have more time. Technology can be enjoyable. It can be useful. It can do amazing things for us, but it also can drive us right to the brink. The best thing to remember about time-saving technology is it doesn't. Time-saving technology compresses time, consumes time. All the countries with the most time-saving technologies are the most stressed-out countries. I've been to them. There's a guy from Mali who says, you guys have all the watches. We have all the time. Let's take a look at time-saving technologies here a little bit. Let's take a look at maybe one at a time. How about email? How many people like email? And I'll say how many do not like email, okay? How many do not like email? How many like email and hate it at the same time? Yeah, okay. You know, I don't like phones. I don't pick up the phone. If you call me, God bless you. I'm not talking to you. I'm not going to pick up the phone because you'll talk to me for half an hour and I'm supposed to remember that, write it down somewhere, and you're going to ask me to do something. I have no idea if I can do it. What I want you to do is send me an email because then I can consider that. I can pray for that. I need peace and clearness. If somebody asks me to go somewhere, I need peace and clearness. If I don't have that, I don't care what it is that they're asking me to do. I don't care how visible it is. If I don't have peace and clearness, I just don't go. So I like email, but I don't know if I'll ever get to the bottom of my email pile. It's just that way. I don't know. I feel bad about some people. I haven't been able. I just can't do it. There's a law professor from Stanford declared email bankruptcy. He just wiped it all out. He says, as an act of law, this is gone. I have no obligation to these debtors. I was on a radio program in Florida. The person who is on that radio program, Christian station, the day before gets 1,800 emails a day. I've been at the Pentagon 4 or 5 times, and one of the guys at the Pentagon, he's in the probably top 100. There's 25,000 people that work there. He's in the top 100 in terms of importance of his job. He says, if I don't do 16 hours of email every Saturday from home, I would be fired. Now, before you get mad at the Pentagon for abusing this poor soul, it's his fault. It isn't the Pentagon. He does not have to do 60. He's crashed and burned many times. He's going to do it again. The guy never learns. Bill Gates gets 4 million emails a year, and it serves him right. I have no sympathy whatsoever for the guy. How about cell phones? Cell phones are everywhere. You know, I was in Japan, and I came up to a stoplight, and there was kind of like a mall there or something, and it looked like 50 or 60 kids, junior high, early high school probably. Everybody was on a cell phone. There wasn't a single person talking to anybody else standing next to them. They were probably talking to the person next to them on the cell phone next to them, but I thought that's just kind of interesting, isn't it? And I always said, I'm not going to get a cell phone until the Cubs win the World Series. Got tired of that, and I have one, but I only call my wife. I can't give you a single digit on my cell phone. I can't tell you. It's not that I won't, although I won't either. But I mean, I can't because I don't know I don't know. A secretary helped me with some of my books. Her father died in Indiana a few years back. The pastor came to pray for this old man 3 days before he passed away. The pastor is standing at the bedside, and he says the prayer. In the middle of the prayer, his cell phone goes off. So he stops. He gets out his cell phone, he has the conversation, he hangs it up, finishes the prayer, apologizes to the family, says, well, you know, it would have just kept ringing. And that's what I'm talking about. You know, would Jesus, if he had cell phone technology, would he have it? He's not going to get beeped out of the Last Supper. I know that for sure. Linda and her mom went into a restaurant, and they saw this lady come in with her daughter. Her daughter was about 6 years old, and the lady sat there, and Linda and her mom were sitting here. And the waitress came and handed the menus. And as soon as the waitress handed the menus, the lady got her cell phone out for the next hour, was on the cell phone talking to somebody or many people. And the daughter ordered her meal, ate her meal, and sat there. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of technology. So just be careful about them. There's John Challenger. He's an executive in Chicago. And he says, technology has sped everything up. And by speeding everything up, it has slowed everything down. We never concentrate on one task anymore. You take a little chip out of it, and then you're on to the next thing. It's harder to feel like you've actually accomplished anything. Controlled interruptions and periodically disconnect. What I mean by this is, in a sense, this is what you've done up here. I mean, you've got a place up here where you functionally can disconnect. There used to be a closure on the end of every day in the past. It was called night. And there used to be a closure on it every week. It was called weekend. It was called Sabbath. American society has blown right through all of that. We are now 24/7, and we don't shut down for anything. When you think about, for example, the Sabbath, there's a rabbi who wrote a book about the Sabbath, and the rabbi says, the Sabbath is not a burden, it's a freedom. And then the rabbi said, the Sabbath is a day to stop your work, but it's also a day to stop thinking about your work. That's like impossible. But if we did that, to step back from something for a period of time of depth and contemplation and worship and relationship, and then come back to our work, you know what? You'd be more invested. You'd be more energetic. You would apply yourself better than if our brain is pounded nonstop with the requirements. I was speaking at the Mayo Clinic, and a doctor came up to me, and he says, well, you know, we all need margin. I mean, there's too much stress here, and we all need margin, and it's impossible. I said, what time do you get home? He says, 7:30. I said, go downstairs and find your circuit breaker. Open the door. There's a switch there. It says main switch. Flip that to off at 7:30 and do that every night at 7:30. You have all the margin you want. And he just stared at me. I don't think it was the answer he was looking for. But you see, he's not going to do it, and I'm not going to do it, and you're not going to do it, but it is possible to do. You can do that if you want to do that. You're just not going to. Larry Crabb, there's a Christian counselor guy named psychologist Larry Crabb. He says the loss of felt choice is not the same as loss of actual choice. People don't feel they have any choices. You have. I mean, what I've already said, you have hundreds of choices. You have thousands of choices, the things that you can do Whether you do them or not is up to you. It's hard, but we can't use that as an excuse because, in fact, we can take time away. What happens when God turns off your circuit breaker? What happens when an electrical storm comes in town and shuts everything down? In the west side of the Twin Cities, this happened. 200,000 people for 48 hours were without electricity, late summer. The guy wrote an article in the paper, says something interesting happened. Kids played outside till dark. Neighbors visited over backyard fences. Husbands and wives took long, leisurely strolls up and down the street hand in hand that I'd never seen on the street before. As soon as the power was restored, everybody disappeared inside. So periodically disconnect. If you look in the scripture, not only did they have the Sabbath, but they had the festivals. And all the patriarchs headed to the desert for periods of time. And nobody challenged that. David said, in a particularly tough place, David says, oh, my heart is in anguish within me. I said, oh, that I had the wings of a dove. I would fly far away and be at rest. I would flee far away and stay in the desert, Selah. I would hurry to my place of shelter, far from the tempest and storm. Record numbers of people are checking into hotels in their own hometown for a day to get away. When I first heard that, I said, that is crazy. You're paying money to escape the sanctuary of your house. Isn't that what the house is supposed to be? But people are looking for a place just to come aside a little bit and to wait on God. A lot of times we try to learn discipline so that we can increase our efficiency so we can actually get more done. And that's well-meaning in many ways. And I think we, you know, it's good to be disciplined. But maybe some of us need to do less, not more. But choose the things specifically that we're going to be involved in to be exactly the right things. You know, the best way to do that is think about your deathbed. You know, I don't know if that's morbid for you, but as a physician, I've been in a room when people have died. When you're laying on your bed the last day of your life, you understand what's important and what's not important. If you have cognition, if you're still thinking, it's very clear to you, very clear to you, exactly how you would have wished you would spend your life. So what I'm saying is perhaps go there, lay on your deathbed, think about priorities, the timeless, the eternal priorities, not the trivial, not the fluff that consumes our day, not the glitter and the clutter. So much of what the gospel asks us to do is be available. It is possible that the most important thing in your life is not on your agenda at the beginning of the day. What interruptions might God bring you that will be the greatest thing for you to involve yourself in and bring you the greatest amount of joy? I think about it, get to heaven, and God's going to say, Dick, do you remember Mary? And I think, Mary, yeah, I remember Mary. Single mom, young baby. Baby had been up all night screaming, had a fever, came in, had an ear infection, screaming in the office. I remember Mary. She started crying, too. The baby was crying. I couldn't stand it. It hurt my ears. But I don't remember her very well, God, because she was an add-on and I had a waiting room full of patients. And God's going to say, I know about the waiting room full of patients, but I didn't send any of them. I did send you Mary, though. I just wished you would have carried her burden a little bit longer because she really needed it. But it's those times where you see God, where you see the Spirit of God tap you on the shoulder and hear right now, right in front of you, this is the reason you're alive today. This is the reason you're a teacher. This is the reason you're a pastor. This is the reason you're a counselor. This is the reason you're in missions. This is the reason you're alive. And at the beginning of the day, it wasn't on your agenda. And if you blow past that and you wonder why you don't have joy in your spiritual walk, it's because you missed it. This is God's opportunity for you to pour your life into meeting these needs and make you smile when you go to bed and turn the lights off because you know that you were an agent for the Lord Jesus Christ. Let's talk about margin of finances. It is so interesting that we have untold, unimaginable wealth in America today, and everybody I know is scared. We have achieved financial success that no other nation has even come close to. Our GDP equals the next four largest countries added together, and everybody I know is scared. Nobody has enough. Somebody says, you're going to retire in Manhattan. You have to set aside $14 million. It's crazy out there. There's people in Silicon Valley working 70-hour weeks because they have $10 million in the bank, but they said $10 million doesn't go as far as $10 million used to go. I mean, everybody's scared. is this really freedom? Is this really utopia? Is this really happiness? Is there a bit of a trick involved in this? We need to be sure that that we're figuring out how to manage our money and thus manage our life. And I want to just do a sovereignty reminder here. All of life is grace. From the first chapter of John, it says, for the fullness of his grace, we've all received one blessing after another. I studied for a year in Switzerland, and I've been down to the Matterhorn in Zermatt, Switzerland. And so I've been there a couple times since. The last time was 2002. And I remember coming around the village. It's just a little village at the base of the Matterhorn, coming around and turning like that. And there it is. It just smacks you in the face. Very imposing, very majestic, just beautiful, unbelievable. And all of a sudden, this last time when I saw it, I said, those people didn't build that mountain. They were just smart enough to put a village down here and stick their hand out. The whole world comes and gives $1 billion a year just because of the mountain. It's grace. They don't deserve that. They didn't build it. They're not responsible. How about the human body? You didn't create the air that you're breathing right now. You didn't create your lungs. You didn't even ask your lungs to breathe. You didn't create the food that you eat, nor the ground in which it was grown, nor the ability of the seed to germinate. You didn't instruct your gastrointestinal tract to digest. You didn't ask the retina of your eye to perform nonlinear differential equations in one-third of a second and take a supercomputer 100 years to do. You didn't tell your brain to acquire language. Little baby 6 months old, they go, goo, goo, ga, ga. And then they're 3 years old, they say, give me another potato chip or I'll throw a rock through the window. And we don't know. We don't know how that happens. You didn't tell the DNA in your initial single cell to grow you. Your DNA in your initial cell weighed 0.2 of a millionth of an ounce. But there you are. You didn't create the 10 to the 28th atoms in your body or instruct a trillion of these atoms to turn over in the next hour. You see, before you get out of bed, you're laying in bed, you woke up, your eyes are closed. Before you open your eyes, you are unbelievably wealthy because you are surrounded by the grace of God. Now, if all you look at is your closet and your house and your car, and you're fooled into thinking that is your riches, you've missed it. God has given us so much more. So here's some things about margin. Avoid future debt. Make a budget. Those are all, make a budget. I'm not a budget guru. Discard credit cards. You've heard this stuff before. It's so much easier to spend with plastic. Examine the motives for spending. Why do people spend the way they do? Sometimes it's recreational. It's like, oh, what should we do this afternoon? Oh, let's just go to the mall and spend. It's just fun. I mean, it's a way that you recreate, that you just, do things together. Therapeutics. Sometimes people are blue, they're depressed, and they go buy something, and this is very common in America, and it works. If you're depressed, you go buy a boombox, you bring it home, you play a CD, and you say, man, I feel better. 2 weeks later, you're back to being depressed, and the boombox has gathered dust. It doesn't work long term. It only works short term, but very common. Addictive spending is very common, again, in America. So I'm not saying all spending is wrong, but we have to learn to curb our desires. Because once you let debt become too large, it'll drive the entire train of marginalist trauma and lead to a lot of stress. Resist impulses. If you go to a retail store, they put stuff right by the cash register. And there's a reason they put it there, because that's impulse buying. So 50% of grocery purchases are impulse. 50% of hardware purchases are impulse. So maybe we send the women to buy the hardware and the men to buy the groceries. Be careful about impulse buying. You know, you go to a store and you say, should I get that? I mean, it's on sale. That looks nice. I think I could use that. If you're not sure, don't get it. Go home. Think about it for a while. Return later on and get it if you decide upon contemplation that you really need it. Most of the time, you'll say, I don't need that. I mean, what was I thinking? So be careful about that. Decide your possession endpoint. You see, as soon as you get the couches and the curtains and the clothes and the cars and the computers all perfectly fashionable, the world changes the rules. Somebody in Paris, I guess, changes the rules. You have to start all over again. And I'm thinking, what's the matter with that couch? There's nothing the matter with that couch. If you're done with your couch, sell it to me. I will buy it. When I'm done with the couch, believe me, push it off a cliff. It's the same thing with my cars. The car I have out here has 268,000 miles. Anybody have more miles than that? Nobody. Yeah, there you go. There you go. Oh, good. We'll get together afterwards. We're going to have an old car club. When I'm done with a car, Larry Burkett used to say, you drive a car till it's dust, then you sweep up the dust and drive the dustpan for a while. And when I'm done with a car, My car was ticketed once. I was at the student health center for a little bit, and I was parked in a doctor's spot, and I came out. There's a ticket on there, and it said, "This is for the doctor's car." And I said, "Wait a minute." So decide your possession endpoint. We keep, anyway, I already illustrated that. Fast. Sometimes what you should do is fast from food. Sometimes what you should do is fast from television. Fast from technology. Fast from electricity for a day or two. Pretend you live in 1850. Fast from the news. One psychiatrist told me when people have a hard time getting to sleep at night, he says, stop watching the evening news. And there's also fasting from shopping. Just fast from shopping for a month. Just consider it. And I bet anything you'll still be alive. I think, you know, what we need to do is allow God to rattle our cage periodically and teach us things in the process of doing that. Because our culture is not about to cause that kind of depth in our lives. And examine your value system. There's a fellow who works with Ron Blue, who's kind of a financial sort of counselor. And this other guy, Russ Crosani, he's written a couple books, and I've endorsed some of them for him. In one of those books, he says there's two ways to measure our wealth. One, looking at your bank account, but the other is for the number of things that you have for which you would not take money. What do you have for which you would not take money? That is a more lasting and a more true and a more emotionally satisfying definition of wealth. I want to spend the last bit of time here talking about simplicity and contentment because this, to me and for Linda, it anchors everything. You can try to have margin without a certain modicum of simplicity and contentment, but it'll be hard. And both of these are commended by Scripture. Simplicity is commended by Scripture. For example, in Hebrews 12:1, Hebrews 11 is the Hall of Fame of faith, all these great characters in the Scriptures and all that they had done. And then it goes to Hebrews 12. Since we are therefore surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us set aside everything that hinders. I think King James talks about the weights in our life that weigh us down. Let us set aside everything that hinders. Is there sometimes some clutter in our lives that hinder us in our spiritual journey? Clutter experts, and yes, there are such people, say that we use 20% of what we own and we maintain 100% of what we own. If that's even close to being true, that I use 20% of what we own and I maintain the other 80% that I don't even use, that is absolute. What in the world is up with that? I need to judge that and get rid of that because I have no right to spend significant portions of my life maintaining and caring for things that I don't even use. A Quaker watched a neighbor move in, and the neighbor had lots of nice stuff, and the Quaker was watching him from the chair, and he got up and he walked across finally at the end of the day and he shook the neighbor's hand. He said, "Neighbor, I welcome thee to the neighborhood. If you ever had need of anything at all, please come to me and I'll show thee how to get along without it." You know, Jesus could have been born anywhere. Where did he choose? He chose to be born with nothing. He lived with nothing. He said, "Foxes have holes, birds have nests. The Son of Man has no place to lay his head." He died with nothing. I'm not saying that we have to do that. You can have a house. You can have a car. You can have a nice car. I don't care. I mean, just be my guest. You can have a nice car. I don't judge people. I mean, I don't look at people's shopping carts. I just want freedom. And Linda's we're exactly together on this. So Christ isn't expecting us to live like extreme ascetics. But be careful because things will begin to take over your life. I was speaking in California, a medical group. It was a national group as ophthalmology. And at the end of my talk, as some doctors were here, we were talking together, and I saw a lady back over there by a curtain. And I have good peripheral vision. I could see her. She was waiting, and she didn't want. She had something to say, but she wanted to say it in front of her peers. And finally, everybody kind of just faded away a little bit, melted away. And she came up and she thanked me for my talk. And she said, 6 years ago, I crashed and burned. And since then, I've intensively attempted to simplify my life. And after 6 years of intensive effort, I can say that I finally got it down to 100%. It's a very interesting statement. There's a distinguished physician who was diagnosed as having cancer and thought that she was dying. And there's a psychiatrist, Dr. David Allen, wonderful Christian psychiatrist who had careers at Harvard and Yale. And this is what Dr. Allen wrote about it. Some years ago, I worked with a very distinguished professor of medicine who was dying of cancer. Her word to me was this: in spite of the pathos and the pain, dying is very simple. There's no need for long talks, conversations, complex relationships, meetings. Unexpectedly, after being very ill, the professor was healed of cancer and returned to health. She told me then that she wished she could live in health like she had lived when she was dying. David, she said, remember that life at its heart is very simple. When we're facing death, only the basic things are necessary. Once we move out of illness, we complicate our lifestyle. We live beyond our means, and we make life more difficult for ourselves. I was speaking again in California to a Christian Management Association, and there were some CEOs of Christian organizations that were there, and I gave some talks, and then they were sharing among themselves things that they did in the margin related. And one guy, he was head of FCA, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and he says, well, I called my wife up. This is in Kansas City. She works across town. I said, you got a half hour? And she says, yeah. He says, meet me at Club Mac. They go to McDonald's. They choose the smallest table. There's a table in there that's like, you know, this, just like that. And they order one cup of coffee. He brings a red gingham checkered tablecloth out of his glove box, and he puts a candle there, and he lights it, and they share a cup of coffee. Everybody in the store looks over and gets this tremendous smile. It's not about the coffee. Life can be very simple if we agree with God. And the last area is contentment. Three major mentionings of contentment in the New Testament, but very seldom actually have I heard it preached on. And when I wrote a chapter on this in margin, I had to go back to 1650 to find a book written on contentment. Paul, chained in prison, Philippians 4, I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation. I've learned the secret of being content. He chose the word secret intentionally. Chained in prison, destitute, about to die, and he could be content whether he's way down here or way up here. That is the definition of freedom. 1 Timothy 6:6, godliness with contentment is great gain. Hebrews 13:5, be content with what you have because God has said, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. This recent recession, which they call the Great Recession, we lost more jobs in this recession than the last three recessions before it added together. World Economic Forum at Davos said that 40% of the world's wealth was wiped out in five quarters. You see, our economies did not say to us, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you, only God. So God says, be content with what you have because God has said, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. But it's not a natural state. Contentment is not a natural state. John Kenneth Galbraith, the Harvard economist, said, there's no theory of satiety in economic theory. In other words, you cannot satiate people with economics. There's nothing in economic theory or practice to suggest that you can satiate people. Immanuel Kant says, as soon as you give a person everything they want and everything they need, at that precise moment, everything is no longer everything. We just keep wanting more. I want to show you a picture of our son. This is our second son, Matt. He's a guy who looks like he doesn't belong there. And this is northern Afghanistan. I spent several years here. Beautiful country. Had some difficult experiences. But when Matt was in high school, I used to go up to him. I said, Matt, your life is too easy. You need more suffering. It's a pretty strange thing for a father to say, but I meant it. I mean, things just came too easy. Good kid, made good decisions, had good friends, believed in God, attended church, but his life was just too easy. And I was worried about that. I said, Jesus said, if you're to be a follower of mine, you're supposed to take up the cross. You're supposed to deny yourself. You're supposed to do this daily and follow him. And I can't think of anything you're denying yourself. Well, now, with the work that he does, Christian work in some of the worst places in the world, he has learned about denying himself. This is Darwaz province, north central Afghanistan, the worst place in the entire world to have a baby. One out of three women, according to the UN, died because of complications of childbirth. The governor came to Kabul and got Matt's group, which at that time was called PACTEC, and said, please come, our people are so poor, they're eating hay. So Matt had to fly into Dushanbe, which is the capital of Tajikistan, take a jeep ride like 30 hours to the border, walk for 25 kilometers to this place, help them survey and put together this old Russian airstrip that hadn't been used for 30 years, and then he called in a Cessna. And Matt said, Dad, I slept on the floor of a TB clinic for 6 weeks. And I said, you what? He says, I slept for it. Yeah, I heard it. You shouldn't do that. There's bacilli. That is a TB active zone. You're going to die. He says, whatever. You see, I was worried about Matt before because he knew how to live up here. But I didn't know if he knew how to live here or here or here. But now I know that Matt knows how to live all the way on the bottom rung, which means he is now free to enjoy from God's hand anything between there and here. That is the definition of freedom. This is the Pakistan earthquake. And if you remember, 70 to 80,000 people died. This is in northern Pakistan, and 3.5 million were homeless. Matt's group helped them winter through down in the valley for the winter. And then they had one more month on their contract, and they helped with rubble removal. 6.5 months after the earthquake, the rubble was 30 feet deep in Muzaffarabad. And so they would pay people to remove the rubble, and they had to stop because they just found a baby. 6.5 months after the earthquake. So you see, if you have a problem with contentment, go to the next earthquake and remove rubble till you find a baby, and then come back, and your contentment will be fixed. This is a school, because the school is gone. Most of these kids don't have parents. They meet on the side of the road. That's Muzaffarabad down below. This is Matt standing on a Russian tank in the river between Afghanistan and Uzbekistan, fishing in a polluted river for carp using a cane pole. And then he met Susie. Susie had come to Afghanistan too. She's the gal kind of just right underneath the television there to the right a little bit. And Susie was working in Kandahar. Kandahar is the worst of the worst. I mean, there's no place on earth that's worse than Kandahar right now. And so they started seeing each other and spending some time together. And they married a year ago, a little over a year ago. Matt standing up on the left side and Susie standing up on the right side. But they've had a lot of joy in getting to know each other. They continue to work there in Liberia right now. But you see, Susie lost her prayer partner, Sid, January 28th of 2008. She was abducted. She was kidnapped in Kandahar, and she was brutally tortured and killed. And then Matt lost his only and very beloved nephew, who died of heart surgery in Minneapolis Children's. And he was in northern Kurdistan at the time, and we had to call and say that his little Nico had just died. And Matt cried and cried and cried and cried and cried in a desolate house, dark, no electricity. It was 120 degrees. And my heart broke for Matt as well. And then Susie lost her best friend, Gail, who had left from Kandahar to go up to Kabul, but she was gunned down by two guys on a motor scooter on October 20th. And then Cheryl, if you remember the 10 martyrs that happened just in August, August 5th in northern Afghanistan, she was one of the 10 that were killed. And so I'd like to say that, you can do these things and everything will be fine. But contentment, when you trust in the sovereignty of God, did God make a mistake here? No, God didn't make a mistake. God doesn't know how to make a mistake. God doesn't know how to fail. You line up your heart and your life and your intentions and your affections with the things of God, and then he walks you through life and gives you the ministry that he has for you. What about these four here? They're home. They're having a great time. We are left to suffer. They are not suffering. You know, I grieve for them, but mostly I'm grieving for myself and for Susie. But they are home and they are rejoicing and they are watching us. And we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. God bless you all. Thank you so much.